the Onyx Pathcast. I'm your host, Eddie Webb, and with me today I have Dixie Cochran.
Hello.
And Matthew Dawkins.
Hello.
And we're going to talk today about process, and it's and immediately half of you, I can almost hear you going, oh God. But
including Dixie.
We get a lot.
Oh.
Well, yeah. We have to live in the process. That's a very different style of horror. But we do get a lot of questions and concerns and just confusion about what different elements of the process mean when we say something's in red lines or outline or proofing. What do those terms mean? We have some somewhat specific jargon we use sometimes when we talk about this. And also there's a it's worth kind of going into what we actually do. We went on a high level a couple of us ago about what our jobs are and what we do. But this is a bit more about the actual steps in the process, how we all integrate with each other and how we integrate with other disciplines like arts and printing and so on and so forth. There's also a lot of wrinkles. We're constantly refining this process. That's one thing I definitely want to mention is that one thing that we've been very adamant about as Matthew and Dixie come on board is that we're constantly reassessing. Is this the right way of doing things? Is this the best possible thing we could be doing? And because all three of us freelance with a lot of different companies, we all pick up things from other companies. And we'll kind of go more into that later. But in terms of what Onyx Path's at right now, because we have different licensors and we have different groups that we coordinate with, it did help to kind of have at least some sense of what the process needs to be for us. A lot of times you'll hear us talk about pitches, and that's where a book starts. A pitch is basically, here's the book I want to do functionally. This is the game I want to make. And so it's about a page, sometimes a little bit less, sometimes a little bit more, talking about what this book needs to be. This is an Aeon book. It's going to talk about aliens. It's going to be about 100,000 words. Here are the three bullet points. And this is what players will find useful when they get the book. And that's one thing actually I picked up myself from other contracts is the pitch needs to kind of talk about what the reader gets out of it. It's nice to say, here's a book about Boggins, but having a better understanding of what the value is for the customer at the end. It's really helpful to have that in the pitch so we can design with that.
Yeah, well, working in the game industry, like, our books are to play games, so it has to enhance the product somehow. If it's like a side book or if it's a brand new book, we have to kind of be able to be like, here's the theme, here's the mood, here's how it's different from other books that might sound similar,
Well, and that's exactly that's an interesting point, because one can look at books that have been released, I won't use Onyx Path as an example here, but to use Old White Wolf as an example, there's some source books that were released for sort of World of Darkness as was, and you can take a look at them now and think, wow, that must have been an excellent pitch, because the book itself doesn't serve much utility. And I know that sounds a bit like I'm throwing the book under the bus, but you can definitely divide books between usability and, I guess, shelf filler. So, as you say, the need of to have a book and the saleability of it is, I guess, integral in a pitch. We need to see that it will actually draw customers, draw readers, draw players, and inspire them to actually want to play our games and not just be something that takes up room on a shelf.
Right, and that's actually one of the reasons why I particularly have been interested in trying to do pitches more often, because sometimes we have to because of our license agreements. But you're absolutely right. There's a lot of times where we do books just because it fills a gap, that a perceived gap, like, oh, we didn't do ready-made characters for Geist, say. I know we did, but as an example of a book that we could possibly make, what value does that bring? It's like, well, it just is a thing that we didn't do. And sometimes that's not enough of an incentive. And so having to pitch saying, well, this is the value it's actually bringing. We do have this is very passionate Geist fan base, and they're really, very excited, and they could use some help getting more people on board. Okay, that's a part of a pitch that's compelling. It's like, okay, we're having trouble. We're seeing that people are not getting excited about Geist as a unique concept. And again, this is all hypothetical, but I'm picking on Geist. But having that pitch honed for, I know what this product's trying to do, really helps us to understand where it fits into our overall plans.
Right. And whether that's one of us doing the pitch or an outside developer doing the pitch, like, it's still a useful document to have.
Yeah. And also sometimes as we're getting more comfortable and have a better idea of where we want to go, we can help outside people tune their pitch as well. So it's like, okay, you know, we already have a book coming down the pipe that does a lot of what you're saying, but if you take this part off and turn that into a pitch, and because the pitches are just, again, a page in length, they're really easy to throw away and make a new one. That's the whole point of the pitch process, is rather than devoting time to it and then realizing, oh, this book's not working, we could try to vet some of that stuff at the early stages.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, this is your broad strokes, glitzy selling points document. And this is, and I know you just mentioned this doesn't have to be something that we can do. It can just be, it can be any developer on XPath. It can be any writer. It could be anyone. Anyone is allowed to pitch anything. I would say you're probably, and I have no figures to back this up, I just have an inkling, you're probably more likely to get a pitch accepted if you're a known quantity. So being an established writer or developer or one of us makes a pitch probably more tenable, because again, you're a reliable entity as far as the company's concerned. But yeah, theoretically, a pitch can come from anywhere. And if Rich Thomas, in our case, is the person to decide whether that's a game that could go somewhere, then ultimately the most important information is what's on the page. So you really want to front load it with the most exciting parts of your game.
Yeah. And on the flip side, no one's really exempt from the pitch, ideally. Even when Rich and I have worked together for over a decade, but still when I wanted to do Pugmire, I put together a whole pitch package for him as if we had not worked together. Said, here's why I think Pugmire brings to the company. Here's what I think's great about it. And it gave us a chance to kind of talk through. And we made some design decisions at that stage that impacted all the way through. Pugmire would have been a very different game if I didn't have that conversation with Rich at that pitch stage. Mm-hmm. And so it was very valuable for us to have that. So once the pitch is refined, then it goes through an approval. And the approvals, Rich is always at some point involved in the pitch approval process, but there may also be a licensor we talk to. Usually it's White Wolf. Sometimes it's other companies like Eschaton Media, for example. With Dystopia Rising, we had to do a pitch approval process with them. And depends on the company what the approval looks like. Some want a very structured format where it has to fall into very certain categories and they have to know certain information ahead of time. Others are just more of a, let me babble at you for 5 minutes about why this is cool. So each one has their own little process, but at some point in time, if there's a licensor involved or just another business partner involved, the pitch approval allows us to say, okay, yes, we're all on the same page. We all think this is a viable project. Let's move ahead. Then we go into outline. And usually at this stage, we contract what we call the project developer. And this changes from our role. Sometimes we are the project developer. Like, for example, for Dystopia Rising, I, quote unquote, hired myself. Rich actually hired me, but effectively, I'm also the developer on Dystopia Rising, so I count as the project developer. But usually it is a separate freelancer that we then say, here's the pitch. Sometimes here's the pitches, sometimes even half of an outline, depending on how complicated we get. If there's some stuff that came out from the pitch process that we know we want in the book, it can grow pretty rapidly into a proto outline. And we go to the contractor and say, hey, here's the book we want to. Either they finish up the outline, they write the outline, or they inherit the outline. But then there's a conversation between us and the project developer about, here's what we want out of the book. They pitch their ideas, you know, as it were, what they could do with it. You know, skew it this way, skew it that way. We can kind of have a conversation about, no, this is more what the pitch needs to be or what the book needs to be. And then we come up with an outline that ultimately will be writer-facing. Mm-hmm. So this is not a document that's intended towards the people who are involved in the IP. This is a document that eventually, once it's approved, we just turn around and hand it to writers.
So I've got a question.
Sure.
And I guess I open this to both of you. Is what kind of traits do you look for in a developer? Whether for an established line, so let's say you're releasing a new short source book for a line like Vampire, or a brand new one like Dystopia Rising. What makes you approach a certain individual?
That's actually a good question. In my mind, what a project developer needs is they kind of need to wear roughly three hats. There's the one that most people think of, which is the kind of creative ownership hat. This is someone who's going to be bring a level of creativity and excitement to a project. They're going to make a product interesting. They're going to make it something that players really want to read. They're going to find people that are going to help shape that vision. So they're going to have a strong creative idea of what to do with this project. Almost more importantly to me, though, is a project management ability. So writers that I know consistently turn in products on time, writers that are good about keeping information quiet, and vice versa, that celebrate or spread information when we need it to. People that communicate with me early or are just generally good at communication. Those are all things that make see, oh, this person can probably actually manage a project as well as managing themselves. So there's a certain amount of can they manage this project as well as manage other people while keeping a strong creative vision. And then the third side is how clean their copy is, their work is. A writer who turns in relatively clean copy that I don't have to do a lot of development pass on, which I'll get into that a bit later. But when we say clean copy, this is copy that or a document that is not does not require a lot of work from me to get to where it needs to be. So they've done a lot of self-editing. And so if they can do that for themselves, again, I can usually extrapolate and say they could probably do that to other people's copy to make sure that it's all cohesive. So someone who delivers on time and communicates and has a strong creative voice are all things that, to me, think they have the potential to be a good developer.
Well, so Dixie, to you to go a bit HR and use a specific example. You recently brought Steffi Devan in, and apologies, Steffi, if I've mispronounced your surname. I think it's Van, but you'd know better than I would if you're listening to this. you recently brought Steffi in to take over development of one of our Nighthawks books for Promethean. What made you go for Steffi, who we will be interviewing at some point in the future? So choose your words carefully.
It was a mixture of things. It was pretty obvious from her writing and even just talking about it that she really loved the game and got the game, which I think is super important when you're hiring a dev. It's just that, you want them to care about it, essentially. Like, I don't want to hire a developer who is just kind of like, it's just a job, whatever. Like, I like hiring people who are a fan of the game they're working on. She had done work on Promethean before and came highly recommended from a few other folks. And she, once again, like Eddie was saying, her communication skills have been great. She seems very involved with the process. Her writers seem to trust her. And yeah, her copy has been very clean, actually. So as Eddie was saying, that is something that I care about. As an editor, I very much see who turns in clean copy and who doesn't. Because some books are like they vary wildly chapter to chapter as far as quality goes. And even just typos, just little stuff where I'm like, really, you didn't clean this up? Like, why is there an extra L in the word friendly? It's got a squiggle under it. Come on.
I'll be honest, that's like usually a vetting point for me too. Is like if you can't even do word spell check,
Which
I feel
is
like you probably don't have enough of a acknowledgement of the other environment that to be a developer probably.
A little rough in our industry because I get we use a lot of made up words, so a lot of things have weird red squiggles under them. And sometimes I leave them there on purpose so I can make sure it didn't get misspelled one time. So like it draws my eye every time. I'll get to that when I get to the editing segment. But yeah, no,
Interesting. Okay.
I hired Steffi mostly because, like I said, she seems to really, really love the game. She's very clean. Her knowledge base is absolutely fantastic. Same with for I've just hired somebody else for upcoming Geist stuff for the same reason. Because she, you know, knows the game really well. She loves it. She wrote a lot of the mechanics for it, and she seems to be really good on the communication and talking to her writers front.
Wonderful.
And actually, this is kind of a good segue, because now that we've moved out of the high level stuff, you know, the outline's approved, it's handed over to the contractor side. And Matthew, you're the person probably developing the most books right now out of all of us.
Oh, directly. Oh, yes.
So you're probably very familiar with this part of the process.
Well, so contracting people is should be a simple process. Should be, being the operative phrase in this case. So first thing you need to do when you're contracting individuals is, of course, find out all of their, not all of their personal data, but as much personal data as is required to form a contract, which tends to be their home address, their email address, their preferred payment method. We assign them a rate per word if they're a writer, and if they're a developer as well, but usually we operate on a flat fee basis for developers, depending on the size of the book. And writer rates vary depending on someone's experience, both in the industry, writing in general, and also how well we know them, so writing for us. So there's an entry level, and there's a rough peak level, which can see some anomalies that go above or below. But in general, it's the developer's role, or line developer's role in the case of the three of us, to assign those word rates to individuals who the developer has nominated to work on the book, and providing there are no problems with the individuals that have been selected. And there can be. There can sometimes be people that we don't want to work with, and I think that's fair to say, because sometimes you have writers who, to be perfectly candid, have not worked in a way we deem professional, or haven't cut the mustard, worked to our standard in some ways in the past, and we just don't want to work with them again. And most companies will have that stance with at least one person. So we vet that list of people. If we're happy, we will get Lisa, who's in charge of drafting all of our contracts, to put those contracts together, to hire those people. They get sent off to the writers, to the developer, who sign it, return it. And at that point, the project is theoretically in motion. In some cases, it's in motion before even that stage, because sometimes teams get started before contracts are signed. They're not obliged to. But sometimes they just do because of base enthusiasm, or they have ideas right there and then they want to just start writing before they disappear. So it does vary, but that's the process in muddled theory.
Yeah, absolutely.
Oh, sorry, you carry on.
No, I was just going to kind of loop back a little bit real quickly too. Sometimes we don't find people that we can work with. I've also found that there's a judgment that sometimes inadvertently comes with that. And sometimes there are writers who genuinely just, like I said, aren't sufficient for our needs. But sometimes it's just a case of what they bring to the table or how they work just doesn't suit our processes. And they may do quite well at other companies. So, I mean, it's not always a case of they're a bad writer. Sometimes it's a case of they just don't suit what we want to do. They have very idiosyncratic writing style. They, you know, get confused between the different kinds of games. We have a lot of games. They just don't communicate in the same timetable that we need people to communicate with. These aren't necessarily indications that the writer's bad. It's just a case that the writer may not be suitable for our processes.
Oh yeah.
Yeah, no, there's go ahead. You go ahead.
We're
all very polite to each other whilst I'm interrupting. And by the way, I'll interrupt again now. I'll make my point. Now that I've given you the opportunity to speak, I will cancel that opportunity, Dixie. And say that someone has given me feedback that I interrupt my co-hosts here, and clearly that is not the case. If this is evidence of anything, so I give them plenty of time to speak. So now the floor is yours, Dixie.
I can't right now. No, I was just gonna say that yeah, there have been books that have come across my desk that sometimes the writing is perfectly acceptable, But yeah, like all the terminology is wrong, or the styles are wrong, or they didn't pay attention to guidelines that should have been given to them or that were given to them. And it's like you were saying, it doesn't mean they're a bad writer. It doesn't mean they won't do well in other companies. It doesn't mean they won't do well on their own. It just means that maybe, you know, if they're not going to pay attention to the things we tell them, maybe they're not for us.
Absolutely.
Yeah, we hired Larry Blamire for They Came From Beneath the Sea to use a specific example. He's a director and writer of sci-fi. He's he's directed several modern B-movies, such as The Lost Skeleton of Cadavra and The Trail of the Screaming Forehead. And he was specifically hired to write for They Came From Beneath the Sea because that was his wheelhouse. And I was thinking, well, once this is done, I probably won't get a chance to work with Larry again. So I sent him a lovely email. I thought it was lovely. I sent him an email saying it was lovely to work with you. And, you know, if it comes along down the line that we're doing another game like this, then I would love to hire you again. And he came back to me and said that he does actually write horror and westerns and other games as well, and he sent me a bunch of his stuff that I had been completely oblivious to. So sometimes we have the idea, the preconception, that a writer is specialized in an area, and certainly this has happened in the past, that developers and writers alike have been pigeonholed into a certain group, like that person is the vampire writer, but it may be that they have a desperate craving to write something other than vampire, or that they're genuinely good at writing something other than vampire and they've just not had that opportunity. In some cases, that's up to the writer to really put themselves forward in the first place to say, hey, I can do other things, or I'm really interested in doing other things. And in some cases, down to the developer to go to writers they've spoken to in the past and say, do you have any interest or expertise regarding this genre or game in particular?
Absolutely. And sometimes you can kind of pull that from the workflow, but right, most times it's something that you kind of just stumble across, or they'll say, hey, by the way, I see that you guys are working on Aberrant now. Can I write on that? And it's like, I had no clue you're interested in Aberrant or whatever.
That is one that so many people popped out of the woodwork on, and we're like, can I work on that? I love this game. And I was like, really? Okay.
I remember last episode, you mentioned that you were surprised when that happened in Trinity too.
Yeah, like it definitely had like a sleeper hit kind of quality that I just had no idea about. And also the amount of people that write on World of Darkness or Chronicles of Darkness that will actually mention Exalted all of a sudden and be like, oh, I'm playing Exalted, I love this game. And I'm like, oh, you can work on that too, you know, if you want. Like, we could get you over here.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that as we work on projects, we get to have relationships with people, it's natural that we will start to find other places that they can work in. But I mean, also from the draft process, sometimes we get a sense of what kinds of things people are good at. I know that there's a couple times where I've had writers, when I was working on Vampire 20th, that what they were doing wasn't quite totally what I wanted for Vampire 20th, but they were really strong on a product like, say, Exalted, because, you know, how they pitch their prose and where they're shooting for isn't bad. It's just not quite a good match for this exact game. And so having the draft process where you go through and redline and you'll say things like, okay, you know, this is Vampire the Masquerade specifically has a very kind of ornate Baroque approach. Well, there's words are capitalized when they are important, and has this very kind of pseudo-Victorian flavor to it. That's something that writes very kind of staccato street-level thing. Maybe good for bits and pieces of Vampire the Masquerade, but they might be better suited tuned for something like Vampire the Requiem, which is much more kind of street-level and about, you know, Vampire the Masquerade is about elders making elaborate plans and in that voice even, whereas Vampire the Requiem's about I'm fucking over your girlfriend from last week, you know, and there's a very different tonal quality. So
yeah,
it's something that going through the draft process really helps us to kind of pull out, okay, this writer might be good for this versus that.
Right. So now we're kind of on to first drafts.
Yeah. So who wants to handle that? Shall I take that?
Yes.
Yeah, okay. So first draft is where your writers really go to work. And there may be a planning stage, there may be meetings via Skype, or if you're lucky enough to know some of them in person, to even meet them in person. But the point being that you'll generally have a month, maybe two, to compile the first drafts of whatever you've been assigned. Now, writers in the contract stage may have been assigned anywhere between 3,000 and 20,000 words, could be more than that, but the general gist is not to write over the allocated word count because we'll have a set word count for the book in mind. We won't want it to be bigger than that size, and if they write more, it requires more work on the part of the developer to actually cut that down, and that can be quite tragic because you can, on a 20,000 word draft, have 25,000 words written, and 5,000 of those words are fantastic, but sorry, they still have to be cut because the book's not going to be good enough.
Well,
If
also because if
it's.
every writer does that, you've just increased the book by, 20%. And like,
Exactly.
that's not what our budget's for.
So, first drafts are where, in an ideal world, writers collaborate, they share ideas, they speak to the developer routinely, they let them know how they're getting on, they basically tell the other members of the team what they're planning, and other team members shouldn't feel afraid of cri constructively criticizing or indeed praising the ideas that are being put out. And the developer should, of course, do this as well. That should hopefully refine the work that's being done in first drafts to the point where when it gets to the deadline, everyone has had a chance to see or hear of what all the other writers' ideas are going to be, and mean that there's going to be no conflicting information in the book at that point, no duplication of information, although of course sometimes it happens. From a writer's perspective, the first draft stage is, I guess, arguably where you do the most amount of work. Because this is where you do your research. If you're writing something like Dark Eras 2, which is in the process of being written at the time of recording, you're going to be doing probably a lot of research about your era, and then you'll be researching the games that you're writing about. And because Dark Eras 2 is crossover heavy, to use an example, I'm writing for the Reign of Terror era, so I'm specifically writing about Mummy in the Reign of Terror, which means I've got to research history and I've got to research Mummy the Curse to make sure I'm not conflicting with anything previously published for Mummy, and I'm basically keeping in scope, I guess, of the mythology of that game line. So there's a lot of planning that goes into it, but then of course you have to type your words. And depending on how long you've got, it may make sense for the writers to schedule that they do a certain number of words a night. A lot of people do this. I'll say, as long as I get 1,000 words a night done, I'll be absolutely fine. I've got 30 nights and I've only got 20,000 words to write, so 1,000 words a night, I'll be fine. And that's a really good way of working. Other people like to do it in big bulk sort of dumps of word count. They'll just write as much as they can in a given day and then revisit it a day later with a fresh mind and start cutting away. Personally, my preference has always been to not review the work I've written until I get to the end of it. I consider that a zero or even minus 0.1 draft, and then I just cut, and then I go over again. You know, it may not be efficient, but that's the way my mind often works. So you get to the end of first drafts, to the deadline that's been set. It may well be that some of the writers won't meet the deadline due to outside circumstances, or in some cases, in internal circumstances. To use a current example with Vampire the Requiem, one of the books that's being written for that, I think it's in final drafts right now, has got one draft that will basically lead into another two chapters. So until that draft is finished, the other two chapters cannot be finished. So if that writer needs an extension for whatever reason, and I've got to say they're generally good reasons, it's a pretty tragic state of affairs when a writer just disappears or doesn't give you a reason. The other two writers have got to wait before they can do their part. And providing that's fine with them, because bear in mind they are contracted, but most of the time writers are good with this. they will wait, they'll get an extension. No one will be penalised because we realise as developers this is something of an interlocking puzzle. And once that draft's in, the other two writers will do their bit, and boom, you've got your first drafts up to redline stage. And that's where we big bad developers hove back in with our red lines. Who wants to talk about red lines, or does anyone want to add anything about first drafts?
Well, I mean, I think you pretty much covered it really well. And I think one thing that new writers sometimes don't get is that there's a bit of a precarious balance on the first draft. Is that some writers I find, especially newer writers, will just send literally the first draft. I was like, I wrote this down; it is now yours. And that's a lot of work on the developer's end to try to get it up to speed before you can then start actually applying what's actually the redline process. So you want to get them, you want to develop as polished of a draft as possible, while also knowing that that draft can potentially be heavily cut for reasons that have nothing to do with you.
Right.
So there's a kind of a tricky balance for that, because the redline process ideally is not you're a terrible writer and you need to be fixed. Ideally, the redline process is, how can we make this better? Or this piece now connects to this other piece this writer's working on. Or I was looking for A and you gave me a little too much B, so let's put more A into that. The redline process is more kind of taking the whole document and trying to build it into a cohesive structure across the board, trying to synthesize all the writer's work at the same time. So if I'm getting a poor draft and I have to edit it to get it to a point where I can then start redlining it, that's twice as much work for me. So it is sometimes a tricky balance, and it usually takes a few tries for writers to realize where that balance is. But that's where communication comes in. I know Matthew has been experimenting a lot with Skype, and that's actually been really well. I've been on a couple of those projects where it's people can talk during the first draft phase to eliminate some of that developer overhead.
Yeah, in a way, being completely mercenary about it, it's to cut down on work for myself in the future. And I don't think that's necessarily a bad thing, but I think it also increases the camaraderie on a book. If you've got the writers talking to each other early on, they feel more invested in the project. And I hate to say it, but if a writer is adamant that they don't want to get involved in any planning meetings and they just want to get their head down and write it, while that their work may be absolutely fine, it will require more coordination on the part of the developer at a later stage to fit it into the rest of the ensemble piece. And that, I don't want to say it can reflect badly on the writer, but it's like any team-based project. If one person is determined to go off by themselves and work alone, it isn't always what the developer requires. And to build on what you've just said, Eddie, about the idea isn't that they just put their first, I guess, ideas forward as first draft. And sometimes the developer needs to do a lot of coordination over red line stage. Contagion Chronicle, as an example, I've recently sent earlier today, as a time of recording, I sent an email to the writers to say, you've all got your red lines back. This is your deadline for final drafts. Here's a few things I want everyone to now do. So you've all got your own individual red lines to look at, that's fine. But one thing I want all the setting writers to do is put a specific splat-based condition in their chapters, because, big spoilers, there's, I think, 12 settings in the Contagion Chronicle book, ranging from Edinburgh to Antarctica. And while each one is crossover friendly, each one has a focus on a specific splat being a game line like Vampire, the Requiem, Wealth of the Forsaken, and so on. And one thing I want now, and has become apparent only after doing red lines and seeing, okay, these are consistencies, these are the inconsistencies between the drafts, is I want a Chronicles of Darkness condition or tilt that is splat specific. So if Edinburgh's focus is Mummy the Curse, I want a mummy-based condition in Edinburgh. if Sittard in the Netherlands is Promethean focused, I want a Promethean condition or the like. I'm not necessarily using those examples because they're accurate, but that's my point. But that only became apparent after doing red lines. So sometimes the developer will do it and they'll realize there's points that they missed in outline, and they will ask the writers to make amendments come final drafts, such as that.
Right. On a similar basis for Dystopia Rising, I'm in the middle of red lines for that myself right now. And because it's a core rulebook and it's a brand new game line for us, there's a lot more that has to be kind of spelled out. And I hired a whole bunch of people, some of which aren't familiar with Dystopia Rising, some of which aren't, and that was intentional. But there are occasionally times where the very established DR writers, I have to explain to them, actually, you need to spell this out a bit more. You need to kind of give more of a context for what you're saying here. But more importantly, I have to give them all their red lines in one lump. You gave them red lines, each person red lines individually. I have to give mine as all one lump because there's a lot of, okay, I need you to reference chapter 12 because that material is covered there, but I need you to take this chunk that's not covered there and spell that out more because that's specific to your combat chapter or whatever. There's a lot of interweaving that's happening because I have a very large team on DR. So yeah, the red line process is a bit of, this is where the project coordination stuff kind of comes in, is the, okay, this writer, you know, these writers over here are working on this bit, but they have to coordinate with that bit. And writers who can proactively work in the team environment are always extremely beneficial.
So what are red lines? Does anyone here want to explain what red lines actually are? Because we've been talking about them now for a few minutes, but we've not actually said what a red line is.
Yeah, red lines are effectively... it's a term from editing, but specifically what we're doing is giving visible editing comments for the writer to address. I know at least I use track changes in Word. I think most of us use track changes in Word at this point. Mm-hmm. But the idea is that we're putting Word comments into the documents. We're deleting stuff and making it clear to the writer what has been changed towards a certain end. It's the, you know, a good example of red lines you gave me, Matthew, for Contagion Chronicles, since we're talking about that, is there a couple times where I didn't capitalize things consistently, and so you made a couple of corrections and then said, check the rest of the document to make sure it's done this way. And so that is different from, like, say, what Dixie does, because this is red lines with the goal of educating the writers so that they can do something with that information for the next draft.
You're also checking things like setting in mechanics and making sure that's all accurate during red lines, because there are definitely times where you're like, oh, look at this mechanic, this is not the way this actually should work, like, let's, you know, switch it here. And even moving things, like, I saw some of the red lines for Gai second edition, and it was like, oh, this would actually work better up here, or maybe we should move this section to chapter 6, you know, just like little stuff like that too.
Absolutely. And I know in my development style, I'll also basically the line I always give is that if I give a statement, then it's a, you need to change this. If I have a question, it's, I want to actually have a discussion with the writer about this topic. I'm not sure, you know, should we do A or B? I'd like your thoughts. So it's another place to also, the red lines are very much a conversation with the writer. You know, does this work better here or there? I'm not sure. Whereas if I say, no, actually, this definitely works better here, move it to there. So you're right. Yeah, this is definitely kind of a high level. This isn't a copy edit stage at all, even though we're using copy edit language. My reference to capitalization was primarily for the fact that because the Contagion Chronicles synthesizing a dozen different games lexicon, we're trying to get as much of that at the early stage as possible. It's from Matthew's perspective, it's a, let's get this all on the same page now, because it's going to be a nightmare to edit if we don't at least make an attempt at this.
Yeah, thank you. Your editor loves you when you do that.
It's quite all right. I can honestly say, though, that this is a colossal pain in the ass. And the reason I say that is because, to use this book as a very good example of such an issue, Chronicles of Darkness, of course, has many, many game lines. And to use the simplest example, Promethean has a capital P. Right. Mage has a lowercase m. Yes. And if you take that across all of the Chronicles of Darkness lines and you start thinking about every splat, every sub-splat, every... the hell. look at Vampyre, from Covenant to Clan to Bloodline to Princes to Elysium to the Dance Macabre and so on, you've got some terms and terminology that is capitalized and some that isn't. And when you then expand that across all of Chronicles of Darkness, you have a book with a huge range of terms that look very strange, especially if they're in a list.
Yep.
Because at that point you've got lowercase vampire, werewolf, mage, or uppercase Promethean, and do you say changing or do you say lost, and so on.
There also there's so many times when like you're referring to the same thing by different terms. So in Geist, just because that's what I'm working on right now, so I keep thinking about it, you have, Geist, which is lowercase, and then Sinister, which is uppercase, and then Bound, which is uppercase. But then if you say Ghost or Spectre or whatnot, that's lowercase, and I'm just constantly just kind of like, ooh. And you always find that one instance where it's not, and you have to go back and check it. It's a whole thing.
Exactly. And what Eddie said about, in his red lines in particular, I said, change this, and then I added a comment and said, pretty much, look through your draft and you do it. I didn't do it in such a, to hell with this way. But the fact is I can rely on Eddie to scan through and know what he's looking for and raise any pertinent issues on our group Slack channel. If we have a particularly new writer who has the same problems, in their case, I'm far more likely to go through the entire thing and change, and give them a little bit of blurb at the top of their draft to say, so I've done this and this is why. Because while it will make their work look a lot bloodier, to use a Dansky term, Rich Dansky is well known for being quite heavy with red lines, I think it's fair to say. I learned an awful lot from Rich Dansky's red lines in my Wraith work because of the heaviness of his development pen, I guess.
Well, yeah, I mean, you are trying to, teach them for the future too on some level. How people take and apply red lines to their work and then to other work is very telling of if they're a good writer or not, because we're not hiring somebody to write their novel that's in their head. We're hiring people to write for game lines that are already established. Exactly. And so they really need to understand how our voices work and how our lines work and how our language works. And if they can take that and apply it, I mean, to me, somebody who's really good at applying red lines is an excellent writer. Because it's like, okay, you listened. Thank you.
It's an ideal world, but I would like to think that if you have freelanced on two books and you've had heavy red lines on both, that have highlighted the same issues, let's say excessive uses of the word that, and excessive uses of passive voice, and so on. That's fine on the first two drafts, because honestly, especially if you're European, you put a hell of a lot of uses of the word that in your sentences, and passive voice is a fairly normal way of talking these days. However, when you're writing, you want active voice, and that is a word you just don't often need in a sentence. So once you've educated someone to that at least two times, you hope that by the third draft they give you for a third book, they're no longer repeating that error. And without sounding too final about it, if they keep recurring with the same issue, then that's the kind of thing that makes you think, maybe they're not paying much attention to the red lines, maybe they're just accepting all changes, and that's that. So
That's that.
very droll. I'll quickly finish this bit off if I may. The one thing, and I guess I'm speaking to you now, listeners, anyone who's interested in writing for us and ever gets red lines from us, it's very easy, especially on your first work or on work that you have been particularly proud of writing, to feel the pain when you see red lines. Because it is like someone putting lines through your work and saying, wrong, change it. Hopefully it's a little more constructive than that, but that doesn't stop the feeling of it being a little bit of an attack, or at least a criticism. All I can say is if you are that writer and you have received red lines on your work for the first time, I can honestly say yours will not be the worst that have ever existed. And also, the fact is everyone has to go through it. It is a learning process. No one's very first draft is ever perfect. It would be remarkable for that to have been the case. So, yeah, do not despair. When you get red lines and you have instructions to change certain things, follow the instructions, make notes separately. And to go back to Rich Dansky's example, when he told me, when he lacquered my work in Wraith with red lines, I paid attention to my repeat errors. I wrote about them in a separate document, and I still have that document, and I refer to it whenever I'm writing so that I don't fall into those traps again. It's very easy to learn in that way. But final draft is pretty quick, so I'll just wrap it up. Final draft is where red lines go back to the writers, and they'll have their documents, which have their red lines and comments along them, but they may also have separate instructions. To use the Contagion Chronicle example that I just used, an email to all writers to say, this is what I now need in every single person's draft, bang, bang, bang. And you'll give them a deadline. In the case of Contagion, they have another month, which is pretty decent, because the red lines on this book haven't been egregious, but they have enough time to coordinate, make sure they're happy with their work, read through their co-writer's work as well if they want connectivity between their drafts, and then they submit it back to the developer for development. And for most writers, you will then receive around a month, maximum 2 months, you will receive payment for your final draft, which is generally the first half of your contracted payment amount. So to use an example, if you were being paid $600 to write these words on Contagion Chronicle, you'd get $300 at the point of submitting final drafts, or as near to that point as we can make it. That's final drafts. Who wants to take on development?
I'll take on briefly, then we can move it over to editing, because development is pretty straightforward. It's taking the final drafts and just really doing the final stitching things together. The developer wants to get the manuscript as close to perfect as they can get it. So we have word styles we apply specifically because our layout software uses those styles to reference which fonts we use and how it looks on the page. So that's very important, make sure those are consistent, making sure the language is consistent, making sure that things are leading in the right way, making sure there's no sections missing, all of that. So basically, really, development is just taking those final drafts, making sure that what was done was done. If it's not done, either going back to the writer and getting that last bit done or doing it yourself. There's a lot of us doing it ourselves. And then getting ready for manuscript approval. And at that point, sometimes Rich, sometimes licensor will look at the manuscript to make sure that the manuscript that was delivered is basically what was agreed to in the outline and pitch stage. And we do this before editing because it just makes, if they do require changes, it's easier to do the changes before editing than afterwards. And we usually give them about 2 weeks to review a book. Sometimes we give them a little more time if it's a really particularly large book. I'm looking at you, Wraith 20. But most of the times, about 2 weeks to kind of just review and make sure that it's where it needs to be. And in my experience, if the pitch and outline approvals were done well and communicated well with licensor, there's usually not a ton that comes up in the manuscript approval. It's usually along the lines of, hey, this kind of didn't quite go the direction we needed to, so can you pull it back here, insert this sentence, remove this one line, those kinds of details. A couple of times we've had things like, hey, we really think there should be an extra chapter here, but those are really rare. And then also usually means there's a breakdown at some point in time in the earlier stages. But if everyone's on board, the manuscript's been developed properly and it's approved, then it goes off to editing.
That's me. I'm editing. So Until a couple months ago when I started working full time, editing would go through typically Rhodes Bailey, and then she would pick an editor and send it off to them. But now that it's through me, I edit a lot of the stuff that we work on. You'll probably see me editing a lot of our core books in the next little bit, because I can do, you know, 1 to 4 books a month, depending on how rough they are. Some need a little bit more help than others, but that's typical. As far as what I do, it's editing the book. Like, it sounds silly, but I go through, I check for grammar. If a sentence is super clunky or I don't understand it, I'll point that out, because sometimes I'm like, I don't know what you meant here. I also sometimes catch things like, you know, sentences that end suddenly, and I'm like, oh, something obviously got messed up in this process. You know, it got deleted by accident. Let's fix this. Sorry, I'm saying a lot of ums just because I'm kind of like, what do I do? I do go through and check for all those capitalization things and whatnot that Matthew was talking about earlier. Especially with games, we have an internal style guide that is OnyxPath specific, and even kind of game line specific, because I reworked another one for non-White Wolf games. Because the White Wolf game one is very White Wolf game specific. It's like, here's how you, you know, capitalize all these words, here's how you use this, here's how you refer to that, etc. It also covers things like how we write the word t-shirt or TV, or how we view time versus other numbers and numerals. It's really specific to a lot of little things that a lot of people wouldn't notice unless it was completely inconsistent. And then you might be like, why is this here and this here? Like, for instance, we write out numerals up to 10. And then once it's 10 plus, it starts getting, it's just the numbers. So that's something that I find a lot in documents where they're like, oh, you know, this happens 10 times. And I'm like, oh, wrong, fix it, you know?
Right, but mechanics, on the other hand, do have numerals.
Yes, yeah, but even then, if you're saying one dot, you write it out. If you're saying, you know, plus strength one, it's a numeral. Yeah, it's very, very touchy. I also used the Chicago Manual of Style and Strunk and White Style Guide to kind of make sure that passive voice is gone and that sentences aren't ending on prepositions. Unless sometimes I make the call and I'm like, oh, this actually is how people talk, and I'm going to leave it in there. It is very different from editing fiction, because with fiction, you want to keep the characters' voices and writer's voices intact. And when I'm doing it, I'm trying to make the whole book sound like it was written by one person. When usually it's, you know, 7 to 12 people, and on things like Exalted Books, sometimes like 30 people.
Right.
I'll butt in briefly, because I always do.
Because you're very good at interrupting.
Yeah, well, you know, I do it so politely. It's the point you made about Chicago Manual of Style, that you've got one. I can't recommend a copy enough. If you're looking into writing in any form, any way, shape, or form.
Unless it's journalism, and then get the AP style guide.
Right. Oh, very, very good point. The Chicago Manual of Style is well worth a look. It's not the most riveting read in the world, but it will help iron out any kinks and make your work look so much more professional to just follow its guidelines.
And even if you don't want to get the book, you could Google it. Like, I constantly Google, like, such and such versus such and such, because I am unsure of a word usage sometimes. I think a lot of people, because I am an English major and because I do this, tend to think that I have it all in my head all the time, and that's just not the case. It even now I will waffle over whether to use that or which in some situations. I'm pretty good at that one now, but there are definitely just some words where I'm like, I'm not sure I'm using this right or that they use this right. Let me Google it. So I'm constantly opening things.
Europeans are very fond of saying whilst and amongst.
Yeah.
And Americans are very fond of saying while and among, and neither are wrong. But as we write in American English, we do tend to drop the ST at the end of those words.
I don't usually leave whilst in, but I will leave amongst in, because I feel like that's a pretty common word.
Okay.
Yeah, no, I will often leave that one in, but even in that case, there's things like the between among distance, where between is between two things and among is between more than two things. And that's not how we talk, so people don't think about it, but that is how we write. It's kind of funny, because a lot of people think I'm going to be a, you know, quote-unquote grammar Nazi when I'm in real life or on Facebook or whatever, and I'm like, no, I don't give a crap how you talk. Like, if I'm not getting paid to edit it, I'm not going to edit it. But I do notice, and that is the one thing about having kind of an editor brain, is that if I'm at a restaurant and there's a typo on the menu, I'm like, well, damn it.
Yeah. Another thing.
It does bother me. But it doesn't bother me enough to say anything generally. Aside from the case of me writing to a perfume company a while back and yelling at them.
Yes.
But yeah, so editing's kind of weird because until I came on as in-house, I was very alone in my job. Like, I don't have any collaboration with anybody. I saw the work, I tear it apart, I make lots of little comments and change a lot of things. And it kind of looks like it's been redlined after I'm done with it sometimes, depending on how clean the copy is. And then I shove it back to the developer and I don't hear anything else about it generally.
And actually, I know from my perspective, I've not talked to you about this, but you were out of house when you did Pugmire.
Yeah.
And that was when I really loved what you did on that, because when I'm going through the post-editing developments, it's not just accept all changes. I have to look at each of the edits and review them. But you were in the weird situation of you were basically inventing the style guide as we were working on the book.
Yeah, there was no style guide for Pugmire specifically.
And I told you, I was like, here's some things I'm thinking about, but I like your input. And so there's a lot of, you had some really great comments in the red lines that I was able to kind of say, okay, actually, that's a really good point, and let's switch in that direction. And I've picked up a couple more since then from other editors who worked on Pugmire. But I mean, yes. So there's this kind of weird thing where it's a quote unquote, it's a one-sided conversation with the developer. The editor's going, you might want to look into this, but they usually don't see what the end result of that decision is.
Right. And like, there's a couple times when I have reached out to people. There are two words that are uncapitalized in 20th anniversary editions that you may have noticed if you picked them up. One is that in Changeling 20, we chose to decapitalize the word court unless it's referring to a specific court, because otherwise it was capitalized in every other sentence and it was making me crazy because it didn't look good. And then same thing with guild for Wraith 20. If it's not referring to a specific guild, I was like, can we not? Which is how, that's something that I get from journalism. Like, if you say, you know, the president of a company, you don't capitalize it. If you're using it as a title, right, you do.
Yeah.
So that's something that I kind of picked up from that and then applied to everything else. But yeah, it was really, really interesting editing before I was in-house, because now I can just ping developers and be like, how do you want this to be done? Or what do you think? Or I can just make decisions. Before then, I wasn't really making decisions so much as going like, here's what I would do if you're okay with that.
Yeah, and that's one thing, one of the huge advantages, I think, of having you in-house is that because we can actually make an explicit conversation now.
Yeah, and I mean, sometimes I do still use other editors, because sometimes if there's six books coming into editing at the same time, I'm like, I can't do all this.
Right.
Unless you want to wait 8 weeks for your manuscript.
I do not.
Right. But I mean, in the case of Monarchies, you kind of did, because you were like, oh, I finished it early, so whatever. Like,
That was on me. It's like, all right, so I mean, it's like, I'm not... This is the anticipated time you have it back, and you got it to me like earlier than the anticipated time, but I did get it to you like 3 weeks early, so it's like that was on me. I opted into that choice.
So what's cool about the whole editing process too, that I found out once I started working in-house, was that while that is happening is usually when the developer is writing art notes for the book, which I think one of y'all could probably talk about now. So that's happening at the same time as editing. So they're doing the art notes based on the unedited text, but that's fine because it's art notes. It doesn't have to be perfect.
Yeah. And the art notes are basically what they sound like. We're working with the art director to come up with the art that we want to put in the book, and we're suggesting art. And that's a very intentional use of the term. Mike Cheney, our art director, he's very fantastic. He when he's not sure of a situation, he's happy to collaborate with developers. But at the end of the day, he is an artist, and he's going to make decisions that he thinks will make the book look better, because is not necessarily true that the writers and editors will have the best idea of what looks good. So the art notes are basically, here are the things that we want to see in the book. Here are some suggestions of cool scenes we could put in the book. And sometimes Mike will work with us to try to come up with better scenes. But sometimes he'll just take the text that goes with it and go, okay, well, I'm going to do this scene instead or that design instead. And then the sketches will come in. Occasionally, if he's not sure about if a sketch is mapping up to what is the intended vision for the game, particularly for new games. Like, we had a more of conversations on Pugmire in terms of, is this art working right? Is it doing the right thing? And sometimes we've done a gazillion V20 books, so Mike says a good idea of what a vampire, good vampire picture is, and he just takes care of that. But that's kind of his wheelhouse. So it really kind of maps up the editing manuscript, and the art kind of collides during the layout phase. Mm-hmm. And then Mike does the layouts once he gets the manuscript, puts the art in, and then it goes to the developer for proofing, which is basically you read through the book again, see if there are any other typos, anything else that needs to change. If there's a lot of changes, we're now using software called InCopy, where the writer can or the developer can actually just change the text directly, as opposed to highlighting a PDF and going, replace this paragraph with this entirely different paragraph, which drives Mike nuts. Yeah. And rightfully so. It's frustrating. But now if we can do it ourselves, we could just do it. And then the layout gets approved, goes through approval phase. Since I explained this to you, Dixie, I'm curious what your thoughts are, how you perceive the process from the layout approval on, because it's relatively new to you.
After it's approved by the licensor and or, you know, Rich, depending on the book, then it goes to PDF release, generally, which is where we release it on DriveThruRPG. But we also use that as what we call our errata phase, kind of at the same time, because people will make comments. We'll usually open a thread on the Onyx Path forums, so that people, as they read it for the first time, can find any typos that I or another editor have missed, because I'm not perfect. And sometimes
I'm shocked.
When you're reading a 200,000 word book every 2 weeks, I'm sorry. I'm not perfect. Sometimes I miss things. So they'll find typos, but they'll also sometimes find mechanics errors, and they'll kind of be like, is this really supposed to, how's this supposed to work? And the developer will go, oh God, no, oops, I forgot to put a 2 there instead of a, you know, 3 or whatever. So after a couple weeks, I think, generally, for errata, we'll close the thread, and then we'll input the errata. Once again, either we can do it ourselves in InCopy, which is what I did for, like, the Beast Player's Guide, or we'll, if there's just a couple little changes, we'll just throw it at Mike, usually, and just be like, hey, here's the, you know, 4 changes need to be made. It's usually not 4. It's usually more than that. I'm not gonna lie.
Well, to be fair, Pan's Guide had 0, so...
Well, aren't you perfect?
Yeah, that's true.
No, I'm not. Matthew is. Matthew's perfect, isn't
it? Oh, okay.
Yeah. I'll take all the credit.
And then from there... go ahead.
We did have an editor as well, to be fair.
Yeah.
So once that's done, the errata's input, then some books, mostly core books and, like, fat splats, I want to say, will go to indexing. Mm. Is that correct?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So that's where we actually build an index, which not every book needs, but many books do. Since our books are essentially reference books, when you look at it that way, a lot of people want to be able to flip to the back and go, where is this mentioned? I want to figure that out. So we have separate indexers. They'll do their thing.
That's a very specific skill set, too.
Yeah, I don't know how they do it. It's really interesting. I've seen the index files before they get put into the actual, like, back of the book, and they're just fascinating to kind of look at and be like, oh, you just literally went through and found every instance this was mentioned, and cool. It's a big process that I might be able to do with training, but that I haven't tried to do so far. And then we release the final PDF and then send that off, I want to say, to the printer to get a proof done.
Yeah, and it's usually the POD printer. Sometimes we've been doing some more what we call offset printing, which is the traditional printing press that most people are familiar with, where you have the big presses and they print out, like, thousands of books. That's what we call offset printing.
That's the industry that my grandfather was in his whole life.
Oh, really?
Yeah. My family's in the printing industry since the, like, 50s. I used to go to the printing press all the time when I was a kid.
You continue to be cooler every time I talk to you. I suppose Matthew is never cooler. But usually that's the print demands process. Either the offset, actually, if both the offset printer and the POD printer, if we're using both, we'll send a print proof to Rich. And Rich is the final call on it. Is there any error? Sometimes Mike will be involved too, but usually it's, is this page colored correctly? Are the pages in the right order? Is there, you know, this isn't textual changes. This is is there a physical problem with the book?
Is the artwork pages too upside dark? Down? Yeah. I mean, there have been some kind of weird, like, typographical errors that have made it into print books, or print proofs. I picked up a proof at Gen Con last year and noticed that the title was misspelled. But we fixed it. It's okay now.
Yeah, it does occasionally happen, but most of the time it is more stuff like with Pugmire. It was all the art came in weirdly dark, and so we had to adjust the levels on it. I don't know what levels they were, but Mike took care of it, and I was like, great, it looks fine now.
Well, this is an interesting thing, because I think there's some people in our industry and some fans as well who feel the compiling of errata on our forums and the stages we go through in print proofing are excessive or even a little bit cheeky. And the fact is that no editor is going to find every single little error in a 200,000 word book.
Right.
Yeah, I've reopened files after editing them. I think my favorite example of this, which I will call myself out on, was you have a character, Eddie, in Pugmire named Rondo, who was misspelled once as Ronda. And I noticed that about 2 months after I edited it. And I sent you an email going like, oh God, I just saw this. Please fix it if it hasn't been fixed.
And luckily I did catch it, so it was all fine.
But yeah.
But that's the thing. We are using the people who are dedicated to making these books as clean as possible, along with ourselves, of course, to create as finished a product as possible. And I know I used White Wolf, old White Wolf, as an example earlier, but you can, if you look back at those books, see what can happen if a book is given a single editing pass, printed, and sent to the stores. Sometimes you will get books where there's text from the wrong book in a book. Mm-hmm. Or in the case of, I'm thinking back to the Giovanni Chronicles now. I think there's either apart from Giovanni Chronicles 2, just wedged in the middle of one of the stat blocks of Giovanni Chronicles 1, or there's a stat block just completely omitted and it's just added to the back of Giovanni Chronicles 2. But the point is that we get past that. And if people don't want to help out with that, that's fine. They don't have to. We're just giving them the opportunity to have a little bit of control over what comes out as the finished product. And they're not going to be able to change massive swathes of text. You know, if there's a certain power in a game they think doesn't fit the mood of Promethean the Created, they're not going to be able to order that we delete it and we'll just agree with them. But if there is something that, as pointed out, mechanically doesn't work, or if there's a typo that we just missed, or anywhere between that, then yeah, sure, that's the reason we do it. And I think the upshot of that, the result of that, has been the books we've released in the last few years since we've started opening the editing process, post-editing process, I should say, to the people on the forums, is very clean books. Our books look beautiful. The text is almost entirely flawless. I know I'm setting myself up for a fall here, but specifically to use the art as an example, like you pointed out with Pugmire's initially quite dark art, we don't have that anymore. So you can be pretty fairly assured that if you buy one of our products, it will look bloody good. Well, yeah. And I think that's something to aspire to.
Well, yeah, because like in the past, I mean, it would have been just, oh, the first print run of Pugmire looks really dark, and then they fixed it later, you know? Yeah. And that would have been like all the books for all the Kickstarter backers. So the last thing that you want is for all the books for all the Kickstarter backers who supported the project to, you know, kind of turn around and be like, well, why do we get the crappy version, you know? I think going through this is really important. And I've looked at for Beast Player's Guide, which I think was the first one that I did all the errata for, they were catching things that I was just like, oh, I totally missed that. I didn't notice that. Just because I edited a lot of that in copy. And so there were some things that I missed, like sentences that cut off, you know, etc. But they're not there anymore.
Exactly. And so, I mean, that's our process. That's how a book gets made kind of from start to finish. There are tweaks and variations. Each project's a little different. I mean, this isn't always lockstep. Sometimes we skip steps. Sometimes we go go back and do steps again. But this is generally the high points of what a project goes through. Is there anything that you guys think we missed?
I will point out that at the end during release is when we do pay the writers again, because Matthew pointed out yes. the first time, and I didn't want you to think that we just didn't pay them a second time.
Yeah, it's like, never pay them again. No, yeah. And we do wait just because exactly those kinds of errors do pop up. Sometimes it rarely happens, but occasionally you have to go back to your writer and say, hey, there was a table missing. Could you please knock that up for me real quick?
Yeah. Super rare, but just in case.
Yeah. So yeah, is there anything else then?
I think if not, that's then, the process.
If not, then before we do the outro, several episodes ago, Matthew, you promised to explain what your Twitter, how you got your Twitter handle.
Oh, well, you've jumped me with that. I didn't expect this question.
Emergency question.
Yeah. Okay. All right. So.
This is when we get to hear a story about how Matthew killed a man in cold blood.
Yeah. Yeah, and all I can remember from that night was the sound clack, click, bang.
So where do we find you, Dixie? No.
And so the next episode we'll be joined with a new co-host. Because Matthew's currently in court.
Yeah, I didn't know we had to do a background check on you before we started this podcast.
Well, that was turns down to out. Rich. If he didn't do it, that's
very sinister.
Okay, so I am a big comic book fan. I was probably a bigger comic book fan 10 years ago than I am now, but I was always more DC than Marvel. Everyone seems to lean one way or another.
Ooh.
And I was playing online in a DC Comics role-playing game via LiveJournal. Remember that?
And, oh, God. Yeah, back in the day.
Yeah. And in this community, which was called the JLA, so Justice League of America, Watchtower community on LiveJournal, every player could have a character, and once they've been playing there for 2 months, they could pick up a second character, and I think the maximum number of characters you could have was five, and you could have heroes and villains. For the most part, they were pulled from the comics rather than created wholesale, and so it was a little like writing just our own comic books, but role-playing them using the characters from those comics. And mm-hmm. one of the newer characters that had been introduced in the comics at the time was in Green Arrow, a villain who Kevin Smith had created by the name of Onomatopoeia, who mm-hmm. only ever spoke in sound effects. So the little speech bubbles that would appear next to Onomatopoeia's hooded face would just say things like bang and oof and so on. And Onomatopoeia would use that to describe what he or she was about to do. So if Onomatopoeia was about to shoot someone, Onomatopoeia would say, clack, click, bang, and there you go. And on LiveJournal, you had to have a username for every single profile, and mm-hmm. my username for Onomatopoeia was clack, click, bang. And as I was playing in this when I first started up my YouTube channel, my initial username was clack click bang, and so that was my username on most social media around the time, and has just kind of stuck. And yeah, that is the reason I am clack click bang on Twitter. It's tied into role playing, like Very everything cool. else in my life. Role playing and comics.
Role playing and comics. Yep. Yeah.
So where can they find you now on social media?
I'm still clack click bang on Twitter for the time being. Although on YouTube and on the Onyx Path forums, I am the Gentleman Gamer. And you can find me most places as Matthew Dawkins as well. And one thing we've not been saying, but is always worth pointing out, I don't know if a lot of people are aware of this, but if you go on drivethroughrpg.com, and look up any of our books like Beckett's Jihad Diary or Pugmire or what have you, you will see an author list on the right hand side, and mm-hmm. so you'll see Eddie's name, or you'll see my name, or you'll see whatever name of the writers who have contributed. You can search on DriveThruRPG using author names, so if there is a writer you particularly like, search DriveThruRPG using their name, in my case, Matthew Dawkins, and you can see all the books we have contributed to where our credits have actually been added to DriveThru. It isn't always up to date, but sometimes it is. So that's me.
There you go. And Dixie?
You can find me on pretty much all social media everywhere as Dixie Cyanide. That's also my forum handle, everything else. That's Dixie like my first name, Cyanide like the poison. And Eddie?
And you can find me on most any social media website, Eddie Fate, EddyFate, or you can find me at my blog at eddyfate.com. And also, we are floating around the Onyx Path forums. That is theonyxpath.com. You can find the forums right there. We also will post on the blog there occasionally, the episodes. So if you have an episode you want to hear about or a topic you want us to talk about or someone you want us to interview, let us know on the forums. Let us know on the blog. We're always deeply appreciative of that.
And oh, no, no. Time, I'm going to interrupt. I'm going to interrupt, what? Eddie. Just yeah, you.
I thought you didn't do that.
You were on a fine sprint there to the end, but I have performed a run-in with a steel chair. I have smacked it across your back because we have made no...
Oh no, the wrestling reference! Oh no!
Because in the Ian A.A. Watson double A, Arne Anderson Watson interview last time, there was a reference made to Ric Flair, so we did keep the wrestling trend going. And I've been feeling that itch constantly through this interview. Where's the wrestling? When's it coming? So I've cut off your promo, unfortunately, with a foreign object, and I'm
international object,
and I'm going to pose a challenge now. I'm going to grab the mic. I'm in the middle of the squared circle. I'm going to cut a promo on you, brother, and I'm going to say, while you're there laying on the mat. I'm getting quite descriptive now. You're laying there on the mat. My heel is on your back. You're clutching it in pain.
Freaking
and I am addressing
Jesus.
Dixie in the backstage area. And I am saying to Dixie,
oh, no.
Dixie, brother, I have a challenge for you, Jack.
What? Oh, God.
I want you to name one of the Chronicles of Darkness games, and you can choose any one, ideally one that's already been released, that we will have an episode dedicated to in the coming weeks. It won't be the next episode, it may not be the next two episodes, but it will be soon, that we dedicate an episode to that Chronicles of Darkness line. We can pick it apart, we can talk about the game, and importantly, we can get some of the forumites' input, some of their questions, some of their complaints, some of their thoughts on the game specifically. We can do a big sort of essay expose of it. And it can be anything from the most popular to what you may deem as the least popular. So I'm putting you on the spot now, Dixie. Which Chronicles of Darkness game shall we focus an episode on?
I'm going to go ahead and just say, let's just start kind of at the beginning and do Vampire the Requiem. I think a lot of people know Masquerade, they're familiar with Masquerade, and I think that although Requiem has a really good audience, there are a lot of people that are kind of like, I don't know what that is, I don't want to play that. Let's not talk about that. So, let's begin at the beginning and then go from there.
Okay, brother, you've thrown down the gauntlet, brother. You've thrown down the Vampire the Requiem gauntlet, and now you're going to have to tackle the 24-inch pythons, brother. What you gonna do when the Onyx Path runs wild all over you?
Do not know what's happening.
Last episode, we had a blooper reel at the end. If you didn't catch it, go back and listen to it again. There was some blooper stuff of the silly things that Ian and Dixie and I talked about before the episode. But Matthew just puts it right in the middle of the episode. We didn't even get to the end. This is kind of the in-episode blooper reel, if you will.
And see, I thought you were interrupting just so you could say, like, hey, wait, you didn't mention that you should rate and review us on iTunes and Google Play and all that. And then there was this whole other thing that happened.
now you have it.
By the way, you should rate and review us on iTunes and Google Play.
And what's our next episode going to be? Who are we talking to?
Next episode, we're going to talk to the boss, the guy who gives us all of our money, Rich Thomas. And I'm not going to be there, actually. It's probably for the best. Because I've known Rich for far too long. And I know where all the bodies are buried.
Yeah, we're just going to get you to feed us all the questions.
Oh, yes. You're definitely getting all the good questions that you can surprise Rich with.
We're going to give Rich a bit of a grilling. We're going to ask him the questions he's never been asked before. And that's partly over to you, the listener. You can comment on the Onyx Path blog and tell us if there's any questions you want us to ask Rich. Please tell us there. And we will do so.
Or not. I mean, sometimes you won't.
Oh, yeah, yeah. If it's absolutely obscene or inappropriate, we might.
Why
we
are you such an unreasonable dick, Rich?
Yeah, we, to be fair, we could ask that. And we probably would. Anyway, I'm
not around, so whatever you guys do, I was in a different state at the time, so I gotta say.
Only one host and for the episode following.
And as this ending has definitely proved, many worlds, one Pathcast.